Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini assesses the regional state of the arts with Lydia Boss, Program Manager at Artists Trust. I'll talk with Gina Fruin from Spokane's Trackside Studio about their annual Cup of Joy exhibit, and Vern Windham interviews an old radio friend, Garrison Keeler, about his just-published memoir. Musically, we have a couple of seasonal blasts from the past, courtesy of Don Goodwin and the Spokane Jazz Orchestra, featuring pianist Brent Edstrom. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest today is Lydia Boss, Program Manager at Artists Trust, an organization whose mission is to support and encourage artists working in all disciplines to enrich community life throughout Washington State. In addition to her work with Artists Trust, Boss is also an artist with a diverse professional background rooted in teaching, curating, and creative programming. She joins me now to talk about Artist Trust and what it's been like for artists across Washington State this year. Lydia, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me on.
So I recited sort of the mission statement of Artist Trust there, but can you tell us a little bit more about the organization and what types of programs and other initiatives you do to support artists in Washington?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a nonprofit serving the entire state, really focusing on advocacy and support of artists of all disciplines. And we do that in a lot of different ways, but predominantly through grants and professional development opportunities. So that can range from merit-based grants to grants that are based on a project proposal, as well as needs-based grants through a project like the Artist Trust COVID-19 Relief Fund that we launched in March of 2020.
So obviously this year has been difficult for people in nearly every industry, and professional artists are no exception. So as an artist yourself and as someone who works closely with artists in lots of different disciplines, what has this year been like for artists in the state?
I think that this year has been incredibly challenging for artists, you know, regardless of location or discipline. You know, I think being an artist in general, it's sort of a riskier career path. There isn't, you know, a handbook or sort of like set guidelines that you are encouraged to follow. It's very much the life of sort of an entrepreneur and an independent thinker. And I think that when life throws a challenging situation at you, like a global pandemic, it can feel like there are even fewer places to turn for resources and support. So in my personal community, I've seen a lot of struggle, a lot of unemployment, folks who are at risk of losing housing, folks who are needing to turn to alternative resources for food and rent support. And, you know, similar things can be said for artists that I'm interacting with through my day job at Artist Trust. Absolutely.
I'm talking with Lydia Boss. She's an artist and program manager at Artist Trust, an organization that supports artists across Washington State. One of the main things Artist Trust does is grant making, which, you know, in normal times essentially allows artists just to get paid to do their art, whether it's on a project basis or, you know, time boxed. So in addition to those grants, what other initiatives have you launched this year to help give some relief to those artists?
Yeah, so in March, when COVID-19 really first hit the United States, our team at Artist Trust was, you know, blindsided just like everyone else about what to do to support our community. And pretty rapidly, we developed and launched what we call the Artist Trust COVID-19 Relief Fund. And through that fund, we raised nearly $700,000 and were able to distribute that to more than 430 artists across the state.
Yeah, I'm curious, as someone who's been sort of on the front line of working with artists to sort of get them through this time, what about individual art lovers, you know, the patrons who, particularly this time of year during the holidays, might be going out to holiday shows or exhibits or buying art as gifts? What do you think individuals can do to best support artists in our own community through this time?
Oh, I think that's such an important question. You know, right now as individuals, we can show up for artists by buying from them directly and supporting them through support for their work. Also, I think hiring artists for services, whether you're an individual or a business, if you're looking to connect with creative storytelling, or you're looking to expand your website, or you're looking to, you know, invest in the space that you have as an individual, I think that this is a great opportunity for art supporters to really center artists and to try to put artists first when they're considering investing in either a new opportunity for their own business or when they're thinking about the holidays and how they want to spend their money this year.
Yeah, and so getting back to Artist Trust more broadly, it's great to talk about sort of artist relief and the amount of funding and sort of gross dollars that you're able to get out to artists. But I'm wondering if there's a story or an example of like an individual artist that has felt, you know, like it stood out to you this year.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. An artist whose story really stands out to me is James Pakutas. And James is a native artist who's based in Spokane, who was the recipient of funding through our COVID-19 relief fund. And James, initially his work really stood out to me because he, through his practice, really spends a lot of time in community with other artists and also spends a lot of time mentoring youth in his community. And I found that to be probably one of the most impactful ways that, you know, we can be spending our time right now as creatives, really investing in community, lifting one another up, sharing resources, sharing stories, and really holding space for that creative energy collectively. And our team feels incredibly honored to be able to support James and other artists like him this year through this fund.
So Artist Trust, I know, isn't working alone in this space, and we've had lots of support from other organizations both across the state and locally. What other organizations has Artist Trust partnered with?
Thanks for bringing that up. You know, there are two orgs in Spokane that we've recently worked with very closely in terms of mutual support, trying to amplify one another's work, sharing space on social media, and things like that. Terrain, which is a Spokane-based nonprofit that works to amplify opportunities for inland Northwest artists. Similarly, Spokane Arts is an awesome organization that really kind of feels like a sister org to Artist Trust. They have grants and opportunities, also involved in a lot of advocacy work on the east side. And, you know, we're really fortunate to be able to partner with organizations that have such deep roots in the Spokane arts community and that are so trusted by Eastside artists.
My guest has been Lydia Boss. She's an artist and program manager at Artist Trust, which works to support artists across the state through grants, professional development training, and COVID-19 relief funding. You can find more information about their programs and ways to support the artists in your community at artisttrust.org. Lydia, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
For many years, Spokane's Trackside Studio Ceramic Art Gallery has been the working studio of Chris Kelsey and Mark Moore, along with managing and exhibiting partner Gina Fruin. One popular gallery tradition is December's Cup of Joy exhibit. It launches its 7th anniversary show, with appropriate precautions, of course, this weekend. I talked with Gina Fruin about the gallery and this year's Cup of Joy.
Trackside Studio is a ceramic-oriented gallery and working ceramic studio. And it's located down on Adams Street in a historic building called the Adams Candy Company. That building has condominiums, and then on the main floor it has Colvis Holman Gallery and Trackside Studio. It has always featured ceramics. It had previous owners who are also ceramic artists. This particular exhibit that we've been running is 7 years old. The Cup of Joy was my idea. We wanted to try and create an exhibit where we invite artists in to our space at least 3 times a year. And the rest of the months, we've always featured our own personal work in the space. In fact, you could walk in this week and you would find shelves full of beautiful ceramic works by Mark and Chris and myself. But it's fun to then include community and then outlying artists, and in this case, from across the United States, people who I've admired or I'm friends with, invite them to send, in this case, 4 cups, which is inexpensive. You can get them in the post office flat fee boxes. We can ship cups back to them in those flat fee boxes. So it becomes an inexpensive show to run. It is time consuming. I think I'm processing about 150 cups right now.
Oh my.
In various forms. Yes. So we photograph them, we label them, we put them into a database, and then put them onto an online shop.
The range of artists who are showing, what's the geographical spread of the artists who are part of this year?
Kind of fun. We have an artist from Florida who was referred to us by an artist we knew. Artists in New York, Maine, Denver, of course, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. One from Canada, British Columbia, Indiana.
Wow. That's a wide spread.
We had 40 artists. We have 36 now.
Okay. Well, obviously, the story of Cup of Joy has gotten around. You are joyful with all the submissions, I'm sure.
Yeah, our intent on it is to create a broad range of approaches to the ceramic cup form to make the show visually interesting to the public. We also intend for them to be functional for use. The works range from brightly colored mugs or tumblers, or what we call a yunomi, to wood-fired surfaces, which are more natural earth tones. Some of the brightly colored is pictorial. Some of it is abstract. And a full range of firing approaches, from electric kiln all the way up to the full-blown wood-fired kilns that take 5 days to fire on these pieces. There's this whole story about the pleasure that drinking out of a handmade cup brings to the buyer, where if you have 3 mugs sitting on your shelf and 2 of them are from Pottery Barn.
Sure.
I don't want to label things, but one of them is handmade by the artist, and it just feels good in your hand, and it drinks well. You'll always go for the handmade cup.
Absolutely.
So that's why our intent has always been to try and make sure that the forms are very functional.
Okay.
Because people really want to use them or gift them.
You are opening the exhibit this coming weekend, and it's one of your first Friday openings. We are in a different time right about now, so what are the rules and regulations that you're following in terms of actually having people in your shop?
We're limited to 25% capacity, which means we can have about 3 to 5 people in there based upon whether you're in a pod. If you come with your husband or wife, you're counted as one group, but we are a small space to begin with. So we're looking at 3 to 5 people in the gallery at a time. Everybody has to be masked. We do stress social distancing. One of us is sitting at the entrance to the gallery to control coming and going. There is a large hallway where people will be able to social distance and stand to wait to come in if necessary. We're open Saturday also, which helps spread things out as far as people attending. years past, we've been packed on this opening night where people are clutching their cups to their chest.
Mm-hmm.
But it will change, and we're hoping some of that still happens. But based upon how our openings have worked, we're thinking that it's going to be a little calmer, quieter, safer. People have been really cooperative. I think people in the arts generally are cooperative.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
But we have to stay safe because...
How long will the show be up?
The show is up through January 15th, and we're opening every Wednesday through Friday and Saturday between now and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting in January, we'll have some limited hours. And then we always allow people to call us or text us and say, I'm free, can I come in? Or I have family in town and I'd love to bring them by. And, you know, in a pod like that, we'd let them all come in, that kind of a situation.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And those who are unable to come in person, how can we experience it virtually?
We do have, and in years past, we've also had it, an online sales site. I think more that people have become much more comfortable shopping in an online format. We did try this year to make it a little bit more representational in that we included maybe two or three views of a specific cup. Mm. You could see the front, the back, sometimes the bottom. And we included dimensions if the dimensions were radically different from, say, a coffee cup-sized form. And it's a pretty easy online site to navigate. And it's to get to it, it's right on our website.
Okay.
The very first homepage. We link you right to the sales site on our homepage.
All right. Well, Gina Fruin, thank you for your time, the information, and for making sure that tradition is maintained as you open the 7th Annual Cup of Joy exhibit at the Trackside Studio Ceramic Gallery. So our best to you.
And thank you for your interest in it. And we hope to see a lot of our old friends, old and young friends, this coming weekend.
Full information about Trackside Studio, its artists, and this year's Cup of Joy show is available at tracksidestudio.net. Both the in-person and online iterations of Cup of Joy begin this Friday evening. Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion, public radio icons for so many of us who grew up and grew older with that Saturday listening tradition. Garrison Keillor, now nearing 80 himself, has just published his memoir. Vern Wyndham talked with Garrison about the book recently. Its title, appropriately enough, from one of his favorite Shakespeare sonnets.
That time of year. It comes from a Shakespeare sonnet, that time of year. Thou mayest in me behold when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon the boughs that shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang, that sonnet.
And so this memoir, at which you start with your ancestors and take it up to the present, well, what's gone through your mind in the process of writing this book and remembering and putting together all these influences on you?
What goes through my mind is the obligation of someone who is 78 years old and who had an enormously lucky life that took amazing turns. I had a life that I think is probably no longer available. And so I have an obligation to write about it as a matter of history, and also because growing up in a fundamentalist family, growing up in the country, I went to school one day and my 8th grade English teacher, Frayn Anderson, handed me a copy of The New Yorker magazine and said, I thought this might interest you. And it did. I read it and I conceived the ambition to write fiction like John Cheever. I admired John Cheever over all other writers, and I still do. And this is such an unlikely ambition to have, to come from a Reader's Digest family and intend to write fiction for The New Yorker. So I owe it to young people who likewise have great ambition to do unlikely things, you know, to give them some encouragement that there are possibilities in this world.
And as you've written this, you've had so many details, so many exact conversations and exact moments, just as the one that you just described. Have they always kind of been at the surface of your brain, or have they come flooding out even as you sat down to really truly remember this, recreate this stuff?
I did not do research for this memoir. I decided I would not. I decided that if I went back and looked through all of my letters and everything I had written and my hard drive and all of that, it would be a very different book. I wanted to write a book based on stories that I clearly remember today. And I think back to about the age of 3, I have some clear memories. And the first real story in the book, chronologically, happened when I was 4. And I remember it very clearly. And so that forms a chapter, a crucial chapter in the book called Luncheonette, when I stole money from my mother's change jar on her kitchen counter, and I went down the alley. We lived in South Minneapolis at 39th and Bloomington. I walked down the alley, and I was going to catch a streetcar to go downtown, and instead I was distracted and went into a luncheonette. To me, this is the earliest significant story that I remember that indicates some direction in my life. Some of my life, as with anyone's life, is decided even before you're born, you know. Your parents, how they got together, and your family history, some of it is already there. But this story illustrates a choice that I made to disobey, to do something wrong in behalf of something I truly wanted. I wanted to go by myself on a streetcar. I loved the streetcars, and go downtown and walk around. And I did that. And instead of being punished for it, my aunts, I had 18 aunts, my aunts thought this was wild comedy. Something you should have been punished for, but instead people were amused by it. You take something from this experience that really changes your life.
And so that first story did just that. And then another thing that always was kind of said about people was, how can he stand up there and with no notes just talk and tell such a seamless story through that monologue? And so talk a little bit about your even early training in that allowed you to do that.
I had a speech teacher, Lavona Pearson, who told me, I was a shy kid. I was put into speech class because I because I was dangerous in shop class. So Mr. Beeler sent me upstairs to Miss Pearson, and she could see that I was terrified to get up on stage, and she said, "It's not about you. Don't make it be about you. It's about the material. Devote yourself to the material, and you'll be okay. And if you are nervous on stage, you're lucky because you're so nearsighted. Take your glasses off, and the class will look like a Renoir hillside." And so I did, and it worked for me. It worked for me for all of my life. Just take your glasses off. What I did to prepare the monologue, I mean, nobody would get up in front of so many people cold and just talk off the top of your head. You sit down and you write 5 pages single space, and you try to make it make sense. You do that on Thursday, and you look at it on Friday, you look at it again on Saturday morning, and then you leave it at home, and you go to the theater, and you do the show, and you will remember the essence of the story. And what you forget is what is forgettable. And all of the kind of literary touches and the fancy language and all, you will forget that and you'll go straight to the story. It's absolutely, absolutely the case. I keep telling the priest at church that she can do away with that manuscript up in the pulpit. Don't bother with it. Just tell the story.
And Just Tell the Story has been the core of The Magic, which has been A Prairie Home Companion and Garrison Keillor's life. He's given chapter and verse, background, explanation, and opinion in his just-released memoir, That Time of Year, A Minnesota Life. It came out December 1st and is available at better bookstores everywhere. I'm Vern Windham, who has had the lucky life of speaking with Garrison Keillor off and on since 1983.
Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini and Vern Windham. We're grateful as well for these sounds from Christmas a couple of years ago from the Spokane Jazz Orchestra, Don Goodwin, music director. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.